You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 336.
On today's show, we talk about Brazilian geoglyphs, the curse of a Polish king's tomb, and a Pompeian ceiling fresco.
Let's dig a little deeper, but remember, like, some of this may not be accurate or true. This is our signpost. Welcome to the show, everyone.
Hello. So it's Monday, August 3rd.
Oh. You're exposing the date today?
The reason I say that is because I feel like we did something really important on Friday, but I mean, come to find out, maybe it wasn't that important to you. But like, one of the reasons that we moved to this area and that we're going to be here the whole fall, apple season.
Oh, yeah.
You were so underwhelmed, weren't you?
I had one reason to move to this area because it was closer to your family and the others are just incidental. But yeah, no, that is one nice thing about being in Western North Carolina, mm-hmm. Although one of my colleagues that I talked to who's in southwestern Washington state, mm-hmm. Washington known for its apples. I mean, it's called
so
the Evergreen State.
North Carolina.
Yeah, I didn't actually know that until about 2 months ago.
Well, this part, like this area of North Carolina has a lot of apple farms.
I should say when we moved here in March and we were driving around and we started going to wineries and stuff, because mm-hmm. guess what? The wineries are also out in all the farms and orchards.
Feels like. Like apples and wine seem to go together sometimes. Like those growing areas seem to be similar.
Maybe anyway. They're similar climates. I don't know.
Yeah, you find them
certainly
together.
Not in Central California, but.
Oh, no. Yeah, there's not really apples there so much.
But anyway, Washington. Yes. Yeah. So I grew up in Washington and there's apples really only in one major area. It's in eastern Washington, actually, just on the other side of the Cascades.
Okay.
And that's where kind of like Wenatchee, Washington is the apple capital. Mm. That's like where it all is, mm-hmm. right? I mean, there's apples elsewhere, but that's where like the apple festivals are and all that stuff is. But it feels like we're in that area in Western North Carolina. And I actually had no idea until we moved here and started driving around. Like, what is all the apple stuff?
I know. I'm very excited because fall is clearly the best season. And if the apple farms are already opening up for both UPIC and like selling apples, then that means that fall is just around the corner. So I'm really excited about that.
You're kind of burying the lead, though.
What?
Because apples were fine, but we got this apple loaf thing.
Oh, yeah.
And we also got apple cider donuts.
Yes.
So that's really.
I'm going to just withhold judgment. I think we need to go to more apple farms and experience all the apple donuts and the apple loaves because those were good, but I could imagine them being better.
Yeah, I'm not going to disagree with that. We do need to try them all.
We need to go visit all of the orchards. Got it. Okay. Yeah. Well.
So, if we do go, we might find, much like our first article, a bunch of hidden things under the canopy.
That was a terrible transition. Under the, as soon as I looked down at my iPad, I was like, I know what he's going to say right now. It's going to be the worst transition ever.
Anytime you hear, much like our...
Terrible. Oh, God. Yeah. So our first story, we have articles today that we're covering, of course. And our first one comes from...
Wait, we're doing articles today?
Well, I am. I don't know what you're doing. You can just sit over there and chitty chat about apples if you want. So our first article comes from the Smithsonian, and it is titled Mysterious Shapes Hidden Beneath the Amazon Canopy Reveal a Sprawling Ancient Civilization Much Bigger Than Researchers Expected.
And of course, since this is coming from the Smithsonian, we have to say that this may or may not be factually true. And
shit.
Too soon.
Too soon. Are those dumb signs even up?
I don't know. I don't think so.
I don't know if they've gone up yet or not. Anyway.
If you don't know what we're talking about, go listen to the last episode.
Yeah, go listen to the last episode or read the news. Yeah. Anyway.
All right. So archaeologists identified nearly 400 previously undocumented geoglyphs in northern Brazil using LIDAR, which is laser-based remote sensing. Basically, that's not what LIDAR stands for. It's light detection and ranging, I think. But laser-based remote sensing sounds better. And... It basically what LIDAR does is, you know, they usually fly with an airplane. It could be a drone, a really advanced drone, but usually it's actually a fixed wing aircraft.
Mm.
And they fly around. And this LIDAR is a very, 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 very tiny point of light, basically. And it shoots, I don't know how many millions of times per second, but probably billions of times per second. I don't even know. So don't quote me on that. But it shoots so many times that it has the effect of seeing through vegetation, but it's not really seeing through vegetation. It's just making it through all those little cracks and holes that you can't possibly see.
Right.
And
right.
What it does is it paints a picture of the ground, because it's not really stopped that much by leaves and trees and things like that. But once it hits the earth, it bounces back, causes reflection, and then you get this 3D image of the earth. Yeah. It's kind of amazing and sort of magical.
It's so cool that it can go right through all the vegetation and then stop when it hits the ground. Like, it is kind of magical when you explain it like that. Yeah. That's exactly what it does, because that's how they use it to find all of these huge geoglyphs, they call them, which are the, you know, human constructed images mm-hmm. on the surface. And they can be done in many different ways. The ones that we're going to talk about today in this story are like ditches. They were dug in.
Yeah.
But then, you know, there's other really famous ones like
Nazca lines.
The Nazca lines would be a geoglyph. There's some in the United States too, which are mound based. Yeah. So, yeah.
So these geoglyphs have been attributed to the ancient Aquari civilization. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. A-Q-U-I-R-Y. Mm-hmm. And they suggest the Aquari civilization was far larger and more populous than previously believed, which I want to get to that closer to the end of this article. But there's some interesting numbers being thrown around.
Yeah, we're going to get to those numbers pretty quick here. Actually, the researchers estimate that the civilization's peak occurred between 100 and 300 CE, and that at its height, it was an estimated 1.25 to 3 million people that lived across this area that's roughly 70,600 square miles, which, if you didn't know, and I didn't, that's about the size of North Dakota.
I don't think that many people live in North Dakota now.
Oh, definitely not, right?
Not like we're talking about North Dakota, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that sounds like a lot of people to me, and we'll get to where they're pulling some of those numbers from in a minute, but...
This civilization likely emerged a few hundred years earlier, around 600 BCE. Mm-hmm. So probably about 900 years earlier, almost 1,000 years earlier.
Yeah.
So.
And the population estimates were derived by extrapolating findings from a 1,740 square mile LIDAR survey.
That's a huge survey.
That is a big survey.
Yeah.
But they're extrapolating from that 1,740 square mile area. They're extrapolating to a much bigger area and putting mm-hmm. much bigger numbers on it, which is the part that I'm like, about, but we'll get to that.
Well, this is what science does all the time, though.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We always have a sample size. Sure.
Yeah.
We have a sample grid, and then you basically multiply that out using averages, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not unfounded, for sure. I mean, people do that with all kinds of things. But anyway, this LIDAR allowed researchers to, as we said before, detect these earthworks hidden behind the Amazon rainforest canopy. And of course, people always talk about the things hidden in the Amazon rainforest.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, why can't we just LIDAR the whole place? Because we're talking about, I would... probably so say much. Hundreds of millions of square miles.
Yeah.
I mean,
so much.
Yeah. You might think, well, the earth is only so big, but when you just look at it, it's huge.
I have a question. What are the privacy laws around LIDAR? Because doing it from the air, right?
I think the better question is, what are the privacy laws in the Amazon?
Okay. Fair. Start with that one. But
it's probably the same as satellite, would be my guess. There are no privacy laws.
There's no privacy laws, right?
Yeah.
And aerial photography too, right? Like,
well, yeah. I mean, the only laws, I think the only laws that would probably take effect are ones that allow for, because some of these remote sensing methods that are done from the air have mm-hmm. to be done from a lower altitude.
Mm-hmm.
And there's airspace restrictions and things like that, depending where. Again, the Amazon, probably not a whole lot of regulation down there around this.
Yeah, thing. It's just interesting because there's so many property ownership issues that come into doing archaeology, especially around private property and stuff like that. And like, this is one form of archaeology that like doesn't have those kind of restrictions. And so it's sort of interesting to think about what they can do with it.
If you were trying to do this in the United States and you're flying a plane at 1,000 feet over even not very densely populated areas, which is the limit. If it's not a populated area, you can only fly as low as 1,000 feet technically.
Mm-hmm.
That's not true. You have to stay 1,000 feet above populated areas. Around unpopulated areas, you can go lower. You can go almost as low as you want, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, there's different laws related to drones versus planes.
Yeah, yeah.
People don't like drones for some reason, mm-hmm. you know, because they're
privacy.
Drones can just get up and close and personal, whereas a plane has to fly, you know. So anyway, they found all this stuff, and it supports growing evidence that the Amazon was heavily modified by humans rather than being an untouched wilderness, because we look at the Amazon as it is today.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, maybe even 1,000, 1,500 years ago, it wasn't a whole lot different. I don't really know what the climate was down there, but I would imagine that it wasn't dramatically different you know, maybe it was, maybe there were fewer trees, who knows, but either way, people live there.
Yeah.
Regardless of what it was.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And a typical equerry settlement consisted of villages that would have around 300 people in them.
Yeah, so if you got millions of people down there, that's a lot of villages.
That is a lot of village. That's, again, that's where, like, these numbers are kind of crazy. And, like, if they're true, that's just insane how many people live there.
Yeah, and their visibility would have been visible on the landscape, too, because they lived in these multifamily longhouses.
Mm-hmm.
Similar to Pacific Northwest in the United States. They built these huge longhouses that people lived in. Yeah.
Yeah. They cultivated crops, and that included maize, squash, and manioc, which is like a cassava mm-hmm. root, I think. And they also managed tree species such as Brazil nut trees and peach palms.
Yeah. The equerry constructed monumental geometric earthworks, again, known as geoglyphs,
mm-hmm.
surrounded by deep ditches and high embankments. And these sites were, again, this is conjecture, mm-hmm. but it is based on what people know of societies and research that's already been done. But it says they were likely ceremonial, of course,
mm-hmm.
political and social gathering places rather than permanent settlements. And I think one of the reasons they would probably say that is you can often find really good evidence of permanent settlements.
Yes. Domestic trash is a lot.
Yeah. People throw stuff away and we find it, right? Yeah. That's archaeology.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't find that kind of stuff, either they were really good at cleaning up after themselves, which isn't historically true usually, mm-hmm. or they were used for other reasons where they were there for less amount of time. Mm-hmm. And anytime you put this much human effort into something and then you don't find domestic trash, you just lean towards ceremonial and ritual,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it was important to people to build, but not important enough for them to live there or not designed for them to live there.
Yeah. And it sounds like this is sort of a preliminary finding too. Like they are finding all these with LIDAR, but they haven't done any ground truthing of any sort yet. And mm-hmm. Not really ground truthing because they know they're there. They've got the LIDAR proof, but more like just ground inspection to see what's actually physically there on the ground. So I think they're saying that these are probably these ritual places like this, feasting, music, dancing, competitions, mm-hmm. political stuff, that kind of thing. I think they're saying that because that's what the ones that we already know about and that have been investigated were for.
Yeah.
So they're sort of extrapolating that that's what these new ones are probably for as well. But of course, more research is always like the thing, right?
Right. Yeah, these geoglyph shapes include circles, squares, octagons, pentagrams, and nested geometric designs. I read in the article they were like circles within circles, you know, mm-hmm. square within a square, that kind of thing. And here's the interesting thing. Most of the geoglyphs cover about 7 acres. Now, mm-hmm. that's for one geoglyph.
Yeah.
It covers 7 acres. Yeah. I'm like, we just bought 4 acres and a house, and I haven't even seen the whole thing.
I
mean, 4 acres isn't a lot.
It's not a huge amount, but like,
it's a lot for a geoglyph.
Yeah.
It would have taken forever to make unless you had, you know, a million people working on it.
Lots of people.
Right.
Yeah. Lots of manpower to make these things.
And maybe they all came together and did that. Who knows? Mm-hmm. But the largest that they've found so far is over 123 acres in size.
Yeah.
Which
crazy.
Is gigantic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's huge. Some of the ditches measure up to 40 feet wide.
Yeah.
And up to 16 feet deep. Again, with people crazy. With digging with, you know, what we wouldn't even consider a shovel these days, maybe even their hands, but more than likely like a bark or a hollowed out wood thing or something like that. Probably not something with a handle on it.
I think they did mention specifically that they were not metal tools. They didn't have metal. So they were using some kind of other tool to do the digging if it was anything more than just their hands.
Right.
So that's crazy. And they didn't have draft animals either. They didn't have animals that could have mm-hmm. hauled the dirt out of the way. So this is just a whole heck of a lot of manpower to make these things happen.
Yeah.
Or woman power.
Probably everybody power.
People power.
Yeah. Get the kids out there.
All right. Right.
Yeah, about 1,700 geoglyphs have already been documented in this region. And scientists now estimate that the area may actually contain, again, multiplying it out, 23,000 to 30,000 geoglyphs, far exceeding earlier estimates of roughly 10,000 for the entire Amazon.
Yeah.
So, yeah, way more than they originally suspected.
Mm-hmm. Now, the equerry geoglyphs appear to have been abandoned between 850 and 950 CE. And the reason that they declined and were no longer in use is not known. Could be a coincidence, but there was broader collapses of other contemporaneous societies at that time, too, like the Maya, the Tiwanaku, and the Wari. So mm-hmm. there might have been something. Well, I mean, the Maya's way up a different continent, like way far to the north.
Yeah.
I don't know if what's going on up there would also affect South America, but maybe if it was like a seasonal thing that impacted that entire part of the world, it's possible. So
Yeah, they said, too, that they were surprised that such a large civilization flourished away from major rivers, unlike many other ancient complex societies. And I wonder if it's maybe a 300-person sized village could probably sustain itself a little better than, you know, 100,000 people in a city.
But yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, how did they get water? They must have had access to other water sources if they weren't near a large river. So, yeah. And the Amazon is very wet. So I guess they probably just figured it out and didn't need a large water source. But it is interesting.
Could be shallow springs and things like that. Water and table.
If they're not doing like organized agriculture yet either, then like probably they didn't need as much water too. So,
yeah. Well, and you don't, I mean, if you've got enough water intake into your body through like big leafy wet plants and things like that, that you're eating on a daily basis.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that was true. I'm just saying conjecture. Then you need less actual water to drink. You know? So they would have listened to their bodies and known what was up. They weren't sitting there with their 1 gallon jug going, I got to drink one of these every day.
Right.
Yeah.
So because the survey covered less than 3% of the Amazon, researchers think that there might be many more large populations elsewhere that we haven't found yet.
Yeah.
So. And the one of the most important things is that this makes it possible that there was a whole pre-Columbian society in the Amazon with tens of millions of people before the Europeans even came along and mucked everything up. So like,
yeah, that's
like, that's the part where I'm like, OK, guys, we need to like get some boots on the ground and go find the places where these people actually lived. Because these geoglyphs don't support those kind of populations, even though they do exist and somebody had to make them. But like, that would be crazy if that were true, right?
Yeah. And that's one of the numbers that really kind of stuck out at me when this article was tens of millions of people, which is fascinating. I mean, it's a big area. So, you know, it's not like they couldn't support tens of millions of people, but or the landscape couldn't, I suppose. But it just, it still constantly surprises me. And it makes me wonder where these societies would have gone if they'd been left untouched for another 1,000 years.
I know, right?
You know?
Yeah, it'd be crazy.
Before European contact basically ruined everything. So,
yeah.
I don't know.
So, one question I have that I come away with from this is these geoglyphs are probably not datable, like most glyphs of this sort, whether they're geoglyphs or
it would be difficult.
Pictographs, whatever. It's hard to date them. So, if this group of people were doing these for what 1500 years or something like that, it maybe a million people passed through this area in that 1500 years, but it doesn't mean that they were all there at the same time, right?
Yeah,
like is that possible? Like this is evidence of millions of people, but maybe not all at the same time. Or am I off base with that?
Hard to say how they're writing it. Says the Amazon may have supported tens of millions of people before European contact, but
yeah,
is that like a spot census at 500 CE that, hey, there's 10 million people here?
Right.
Or yeah, is that tens of millions of people lived and died over the course of 1500 years?
Yeah. And all of those people collectively made all of these glyphs over that large amount of time that they were doing it.
I think that's what they're saying. I think they said at any one time, there could have been tens of millions of people there.
It does seem like that's what they're saying. So it's very interesting. I would love to see, I would love for that to be true. And I would love to see more evidence of it.
Which the sheer numbers you're talking about there, because there were, I mean, millions and millions of people in North America as well.
Yeah.
And if everybody came over 15,000 years ago or less, you know, via one small or a handful of small populations and different migrations, it's just amazing that everybody seemed to find these areas where, you know, through time, we found these areas where you could support all these people and people settled down there and just found a way to live and not only live, but thrive. It's crazy.
Yeah, totally.
So,
yeah.
All right. Well, on the other side of the break, we're going to find out what some mechanics have to say. They're pretty popular, so I'm sure what they have to say is incredibly valid. Be back in a minute. Welcome back to episode 336 of the Popular Archaeology Show.
Oh, yeah, sure. Let's rename the show.
Hold on a second. I opened up all the articles before we started, and I opened the Nature article for this one.
Oh, yeah.
Where's the popular mechanics?
Well, that was the Nature article for the last
episode. Oh, I just I clicked on the wrong link. Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not going to fuddle with that upstart Nature. Let's do popular mechanics.
Right. So if you wanted to see the Nature article from the last episode, which is where the actual study was published segment, then you can click that link that Chris just accidentally clicked.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this one, I actually read this over the weekend during one of our sauna sessions. Because we have a sauna.
We do have a sauna.
Did I tell everybody we had a sauna? So the Nordic Circle, we just sauna all the time.
Only reason you were willing to buy a house was so that we could have a sauna that you could just basically live in.
We signed the paperwork at like one at like 10 a.m. or something like that. By 1 p.m., our sauna guy was here telling us where we were going to put it and where the install was going to happen.
You're so dumb.
We had the keys 2 hours before he was here.
Yeah.
Yeah. We didn't have furniture.
Day. No.
Yeah.
No. Yeah, you already had that appointment set with him before it was for sure that we owned the house.
The sauna was built before we had a couch to sit on in the living room.
Priorities. Anyway.
Anyway, yeah. So this one's called Archaeologist Opened a 500-Year-Old King's Tomb. Most didn't live to tell the tale. Yeah.
And hearing that title, you're like, what is the silly story that you guys are about to talk about? And you'd be right. It is kind of, well, it's not silly. It's a very interesting story with some little silly side tangents that we're also going to take.
Yeah.
It's not really archaeology so much as it is just a really interesting story and like a little bit of a cautionary tale. So
it is something to worry about. We'll talk about that in a minute. Yeah. But in 1973, archaeologists opened the tomb of King Casimir IV. It's a weird name. King Casimir IV, so IV, Jagiellon. I'm not sure Casimir IV, and then I'm not sure how this guy's name is actually
done. A lot of the king names, they drop their last name when they're talking about the king, you know, King Henry VIII, King whatever. Right. So,
well, King C4J died in 1492. Didn't even get to know about America.
He didn't even get to know. There's a whole other hemisphere. Rude.
He's like, the world is flat. I'm going to take it to my grave. But that was at the royal castle in Krakow, Poland. So this old king.
Yeah.
Anyway, the excavation was specially authorized by Archbishop Karol Wojtyla. Again, I'm getting that wrong, but you know him better as Pope John Paul II. So he was just an archbishop back then. But again, the antiquities and especially these types of things were heavily guarded in Poland.
Yeah, it was a big deal. It was a big deal to give permission to open a tomb like this. And I think it still is today. We talked about one a couple months ago where it was like a big deal to give permission to open. Yeah,
I'm not sure the archbishop has to give the permission nowadays, but at least back then
he did. Well, if they're buried in a church, right?
Or
a cathedral or whatever, then
Interestingly, though, shortly after the tomb was opened, four of the 12 researchers who entered the crypt died.
Now, that is crazy.
And when we say shortly, that's within like a few days.
Yeah, like days.
Within weeks, that death toll rose to 10 researchers. And over the following years...
So 10 of the 12?
10 of the 12. Yeah. Over the following years, 15 people who had entered the tomb or handled the remains reportedly died. Now,
crazy.
That sounds like a curse. And that's what people were calling it. They were talking about the mummy's curse and associated with the 1922 opening of King Tut's tomb.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you ever heard about that, but our listeners, but there were people like Lord Carnarvon, the guy who funded the whole thing, as one of the first people to look in there. They all died somewhat abrupt and slightly mysterious deaths.
Well, yeah, I went down a little rabbit hole on that. Yeah. We'll talk about that when we get to the end.
Yeah.
Cause like that is, there are comparisons to that. And well, basically they shouldn't be. So,
right.
Yeah.
Well, as usual with this one, there were supernatural reasons given, but obviously it was a biological problem.
Yes.
So one of the things that happened when this guy died, it was real hot out.
Yes.
And I don't know how we had that. We must have some documentation of this, but they said that his body was already starting to decay and they basically like threw a blanket over him and stuck him in a wooden coffin.
Yeah.
And he already had like signs of decomposition when they buried him.
For sure. They, you know, when somebody really important dies, they probably have to like take the time to put together the proper like state funeral that they need to have. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, a normal person might just get put in the ground a day or two later, but it just takes more time when you're doing a huge event funeral. And he probably just like sat out for a little too long. And also the weather was hot. So he started to decompose and that likely encouraged fungal growth.
Yes.
Gross.
So these fungi, which made this guy not a very fun guy, just thrived in this tomb.
Yeah.
Right. Just thrived in this environment.
Yeah.
And the spores from these fungi were so bad. By the time they opened this tomb, people basically that were in there, they just inhaled them. And they did some studies on this sealed crypt and they found Aspergillus, Penicillium rubrum and Penicillium rugulosum. Now, I don't really know what those are, but those sound pretty bad. So,
Well, I mean, in small amounts, because those fungi are ones that occur, I think, pretty commonly. Mm-hmm. And in a small amount, it's just a mild allergic reaction, maybe an inflammation, like mm-hmm. nothing too crazy. But in super high concentrations in an enclosed space, it can be really dangerous.
Yeah.
And inhaling a lot of those spores can lead to aspergillosis. Mm. Aspergillosis.
I don't know.
And that's especially in people with weakened immune systems or some other like infection or something going yeah. on. Not that I'm saying that all 15 of those people had that going on, but like I think it was just a huge, dense concentration that overcame whatever when they breathed it in. So, mm-hmm. and so these severe fungal infections, they can develop rapidly over a couple days, as with the few that died almost immediately, or they can remain latent for years before they actually cause an illness, which is crazy. Like there could be somebody who went into that tomb in 1973 who's just got, you know, some aspergillus living in their lungs right now that can flare up at any moment. Right?
I'm like, we've been in caves and stuff the last few years. I'm like, I got some fungus living in me about to just like take over.
I know. That's the danger of these things. It's crazy.
What's that relatively new sci-fi show? Where it's basically fungus controlling people?
Yeah. What is Last yeah, Man? No.
Last of Us, I think. Something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah. That one. Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah, for sure.
Wouldn't have been crazy. I mean, in another universe, they open the door and this fungus king just like walks out.
Oh my God, that would be crazy. It just like developed into a whole new species. That would be insane.
Yeah.
But anyway, so yeah, this is a real thing. It's not a curse. It's just a weird fluke of the biology that caused these spores to develop. And it's like this example of basically an occupational hazard that archaeologists face when they're opening sealed ancient tombs. It's crazy. I mean, you have to be careful about that stuff. And now, modern day, they do take much more care.
Yeah, it always reminds me of, or this article reminds me of Indiana Jones.
Of course.
Yes. So in Indiana Jones in the Last Crusade, the one where they're going to look for the Ark, it opens up, I think.
It's not Raiders of the Lost Ark?
Oh, no. Oh, yeah, you're right. The one where they're going for the Grail.
Oh, the Grail.
The
okay.
Grail.
Yeah.
I believe that's the one. The one where
that's Last Crusade.
The one where it opens with something else, but then it goes to him in the college and he's teaching.
Yeah.
And it's the girl with the I love you written on her her eyelids. Yeah.
So dumb.
But anyway, he's on the chalkboard and he's got this like tomb over here and he's basically showing where the treasure would be. And he's like, X rarely marks the spot, blah, blah, blah. And that's how they find it later on. X does mark the spot.
So bad. Why do we love these movies?
But he's talking about like tomb raiding almost.
Yeah,
and
he is.
I'm just like, if he'd known about spores and things like that, he probably would have mentioned that as an occupational hazard that they need to be aware of as archaeologists.
Yeah.
Whereas real archaeology classes, it's all just boring theory and, you know, let's talk about stuff we don't care about.
To be fair, though, like there are a lot of tombs that have been opened over the years in a lot of different places around the world. And this is the only example of a fungus killing many, many people that we know of.
That we're aware of.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if other people, archaeologists, especially when you go back far enough, they always seem old, right? Mm-hmm. They never seem younger. So somebody older, you know, ish could mm-hmm. have opened something and they could have died for other reasons and not been attributed to this, right?
That's true. So, that's true. Yeah. Well,
anyway,
obviously it's something to be careful about. And so modern archaeologists do things, you know, they do protective equipment, ventilation, microbial testing if they need to like reduce exposure to these kind of things. We do science. So I would assume that in the last 50 years that if something were to be encountered, they were able to mitigate it ahead of time and not have it cause deaths. So,
yeah. So let's find out a little bit more about the mummy's curse of King Tut.
Yeah. Cause like, it's sort of a parallel thing where it absolutely was not a pathogen that caused everybody to die, but
it wasn't a pathogen.
It was not. Mm-hmm. No. So, okay. Lord Carnarvon, like you had said, he was the money, right? That funded the search for, well, anything really, I think, in Egypt, but they found King Tut.
Yeah.
And he died approximately 5 months after the tomb was opened.
Oh, and that's right. The mosquito.
Yeah. So he was bitten on his cheek by a mosquito. While shaving, he reopened that bite and it became infected later on.
Pretty sure I've done exactly that same thing.
I know, right? It's actually a really easy thing to do. And so he developed blood poisoning, which is septicemia. And then he later pneumonia happened as well. And basically all of those things together killed him at the age of 56.
Right.
And his death after opening King Tut's tomb, you know, it is, well, I mean, 5 months, it's still a bit of time, but there has been a hypothesis out there that it was that same disease, the aspergillosis, the fungal infection, same as the one that killed these guys that worked on this tomb. Mm-hmm. But there's really no, I mean, somebody, they did a study in 2003 with this theory, but like, there's just no evidence for that. The way his death is pretty well documented of what exactly happened. And like, none of that stuff makes you think that it was a fungus that caused it. So,
yeah, I mean, there were apparently at least 5 other people connected to this excavation that died relatively young.
Yeah.
And you
like,
know,
by young, we're talking like 50s. We're not talking like 20s, yeah. Ooh, you know,
young as 50s,
like 40s and 50s.
I feel great.
Well, people who should have lived longer. So,
but of course, this ignores the dozens and dozens of other people who lived normal long lives.
Yeah.
Right?
So. Yeah. And I looked into those handful of people that were connected to the excavation, and basically none of them died from things that could be fungal related. Mm-hmm. There was like cancer. There was somebody who died from like pneumonia and just general poor health because they had always been in poor health. So like, I don't know. I guess there's still like a small like bit of a maybe there was some kind of pathogen in that cave that helped kick off this, but probably not. And most of it happened over years. It wasn't this quick within days and weeks situation. It was years. And yeah, it's just a myth, a curse, not a real curse. So one of the reasons why this story grew and became the myth that it is today is because of the journalism practices of the time. And also because there was...
Yeah, that would never happen now.
Well, I mean, right. But there was a lot of sensationalism in the journalistic titles.
Again, that would never happen now.
Yeah, I know.
Clickbait of the 20s.
Right. Yeah, they definitely had clickbait. So there's also an increasing public interest in Egyptology in general. So the story just kept alive and alive. And every time somebody died who was anywhere near the excavation, they're like, the curse. And like, it would come back up in the papers. And it just got cemented into like urban myth that this mm-hmm. was how this, there was a mummy's curse. So yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things I loved about doing this research is the quote. You've probably heard this before. It was in like a movie or whatever, but death shall come on swift wings to him who disturbs the king.
Yeah.
That was probably coined by one of the newspaper articles. It's not on a tomb anywhere. I don't think it's even in any of the movies. It's just like one of those phrases that got thrown mm-hmm. around. So anyway, yeah.
Nice. All right. Well, some other people who got thrown around were the people of Pompeii. Too soon?
It's always too soon for Pompeii.
Oh my God. Anyway, they're putting together a really cool fresco over there, a ceiling fresco. And we're going to talk about that on the other side of the break. Back in a minute. Welcome back to episode 336 of the Archaeology Show. And we're going to do another article from the Smithsonian. So the previous warning stands. It may contain inaccurate information.
I love Smithsonian articles. They're my favorite.
They really should lean into that and just put like a warning up when you go to the website.
Yeah. No, they shouldn't.
It's like I saw showed you this, the news article about the New Bedford Whaling Museum, mm-hmm. which we went to in Connecticut.
Oh, that's right.
And
yeah.
Somebody left a 1-star review that said worst aquarium ever because it's not an aquarium. Yeah, there's a bunch of dead animals in there.
It's like a history museum about the history of whaling in that town.
Yeah. Yeah,
we even talked about it on the podcast.
I know. And they
a cool place.
They put it on t-shirts and hats and everything. 1-star.
I know. I'm so mad they did that after we visited. Like, it almost makes me want to go back just to get one of those because that's the best ever.
Worst aquarium ever. All right. Anyway, yeah. This article is again from Smithsonian, and it's a rare ceiling fresco from Pompeii that archaeologists are carefully reassembling piece by piece like an ancient puzzle. It actually is an ancient puzzle.
It is definitely an ancient puzzle. It sounds both awful and like really fun all at the same time.
Yes.
So archaeologists at Pompeii have partially reconstructed a Roman ceiling fresco. And those are apparently very rare. I guess usually the ceilings are not, you know,
mm-hmm.
fresco. Yeah, they're not frescoed or stone or whatever. Yeah. So it's one of the few surviving examples that has ever been found at the site.
Yep. The fresco originally decorated the vaulted ceiling of an upper floor banquet hall in a house connected to a bakery, which as long as it's in your notes, I read in the article, may have been known as a prison bakery. But we'll get to that in a minute.
It's in the notes. Yeah. No, it's terrible, right?
Yeah. I love it's just a thought of a prison bakery. Anyway.
That sounds like your kind of prison, honestly.
I mean, I would go to that bakery. There must be a prison bakeries, though. They eat bread. Yeah, I mean, in prisons today.
I would definitely bake bread in prison if that
Who
was...
are the bakers in prison?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, Pompeii was buried, obviously, during the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in 79 CE, preserving many of the structures and artworks. I've been there twice. It's just an amazing place.
Yeah, I've been there once, but I would really love to go back because I feel like it almost overwhelms you the first time you go. And like you need more time, just more time.
Yeah, you know? I was 21 and I could barely really comprehend what I was doing or seeing. It was just so crazy. And of course, I was in the Navy, and I think the tour group we were with, like, they organized these tours. We weren't just walking around. And I think they probably knew we were in the Navy because the thing that sticks out in my head is the brothels.
Yeah.
They showed us the brothels, but I don't remember seeing those.
It sticks out in my head, too, from when we went. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Because they, you know, they had the pictures on the wall and they were like, people spoke lots of different languages. So if you didn't speak Roman or whatever, you could
point to what you want. Yeah. There you go.
Anyway. So since 2023, archaeologists have recovered hundreds of plaster fragments from the collapsed ceiling of this banquet hall. And they believe that it originally had a curved vaulted design.
Yeah. To aid reconstruction, conservators built a custom curved support matching the ceiling's original shape. And you take a look at the pictures.
Yeah, look at the pictures for sure. There's really good pictures in this article.
They're assembling the fresco like a giant jigsaw puzzle. So they've got all these pieces. And again, they don't have they're not putting together a mosaic in the sense that they've got the original, like, individual pieces. They're still attached to this, like, plaster surface.
Yeah.
And in chunks, basically. Mm-hmm. Probably small chunks at times, but in chunks. So
it's still so crazy when you watch them doing that, because, like, how ridiculously hard would that be?
Yeah.
There's the top picture is five people just standing all in a row holding chunks of this stuff in their hand and, like, oh my gosh, it's just so hard.
Not only that, but they don't know what picture they're constructing.
Right. They don't have the puzzle box. There's no puzzle box here.
Like that. It's like that story that, you know, when they put the last piece into the puzzle and it's them putting the puzzle together. And some Pompeian king is looking at them.
Yeah.
So anyway, they constructed more than one quarter of the ceiling using approximately 1,000 fragments. So they have got, you know, if that math is right, a mere 3,000 more to go.
That's all. The support structure allows additional fragments to be added as excavation and restoration continue.
Yeah.
So I think they probably have what they have to work with. And as they keep finding things, they'll be able to keep adding to it.
Yeah. They unveiled this thing at an international archaeological workshop held at Pompeii recently. Mm-hmm. And Pompeii's restoration team is regarded as a leader in archaeological conservation and uses projects like this to advance both research and restoration techniques. I mean, Pompeii is the story of restoration because we generally know what was there for the most part, and you just have to dig it up.
Yeah. And I love their approach too. Like, if you scroll down about halfway through the article, you'll see the way they have this arched ceiling piece mounted to the wall and the people are working on it, but then they just have like a barrier and it looks like visitors to Pompeii can just walk by and look at it and watch them work. And I mean, maybe even ask them questions. I don't know if they're open to that, but it just feels like a very interactive and welcoming way to bring visitors into the archaeology and this reconstruction piece that they're working on. It's just so cool.
Yeah, it's
hopefully
neat.
They're inspiring future kids to, you know, go down this route, because, you know, you don't always get to see archaeology at work like this at a site. So that, I love that.
Yeah, you mentioned that ceiling frescoes are extremely rare, and only about 20 have been identified. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is most of the ceilings were built from wood, reeds, plaster, and the organic materials that they were built from typically decay after, well, an eruption of a volcano, but just time as well, right? Yeah. But most of those ceilings collapsed because they weren't, well, designed to handle that kind of load.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
So the fresco, it looks like it depicts the mythological romance of Dionysus, the god of wine and revelry, and Ariadne, the Cretan princess. Mm-hmm. And that story is that in Greek mythology, Ariadne helped Theseus defeat the Minotaur and escape the labyrinth before later becoming associated with Dionysus.
Right.
So that is the story that it is depicting.
Yeah, and here's where the prison bakery comes in. The building had previously been identified as a prison bakery, mm-hmm. where enslaved workers likely endured harsh conditions operating grain mills powered by donkeys. So
I know we're like making a joke out of it, how it would be the best prison ever, but like
that would have been horrific.
Imagine how hard that would be, because you're probably in a really dark room, because what do you need light for, right?
Yeah.
And it's just, I mean, I bake bread weekly at least, and it's like a manual process, you know? And then if you have to also grind the flour to make the bread.
I mean, oh, they didn't go buy flour at the Publix.
They had to grind their own flour. So, oh, it just sounds like it would have been awful. Very hard work.
Couldn't they just send an email to the Amazon, and then the tens of millions of people there would have shipped them flour?
Do you think so?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just ship it right over. That's where we get stuff from today. Yep. Comes from the Amazon.
From the Amazon, which is in South America.
Yeah, well, it's a lot of warehouses down there.
A lot of warehouses. Yeah. Okay.
This structure is located in Regio 9, which is one of Pompeii's most active excavation areas. And some other things we have talked about on this show have been found there, including the famous pizza-like flatbread fresco.
Pompeii pizza.
They called it there was all the clickbait articles about it being the world's first pizza and all that stuff.
I'm pretty sure we covered it.
And then ancient electoral campaign inscription was also found in that area.
This new discovery complements last year's uncovering of the House of Thiasis, where large frescoes depict the female followers of Dionysus participating in mysterious religious
rites. We talked about that too.
Yeah, we did talk about that. So they're just uncovering more and more amazing things to the site. It's why, like, sometimes I see another Pompeii article and I'm like, Pompeii again. Mm-hmm. But it is like it's just the gift that keeps on giving to the archaeological world and telling us all about, you know, Roman life in this time period.
Well, I mean, most other, I would say, Roman settlements, cities, things like that, if they weren't just modernized through time, like the actual city of Rome, you know, has been continuously lived in for several thousand years.
Right.
And you lose some of that. Of course, you gain some things that stick around, like the Colosseum and the big works, right? But the actual way that people lived on a day-to-day basis, only really Pompeii can give us that.
Yeah.
Because it was literally just covered by the volcano and then, you know, at a single slice in time. So it's just an interesting thing to look at.
Yeah, it's really great.
Yeah.
We got to go back. We'll do it. One of these.
Yeah, let's go, bro.
One of these days.
All right. Well, I guess with that, please send in your comments. Tell us what we got right. Tell us what we got wrong. We had a few comments from last episode, and we always appreciate those comments because, you know, we're not here to necessarily get everything right. We're here to give our opinions on what we see. Mm-hmm. And sometimes our opinions might be wrong.
We're definitely like guilty of talking off the cuff too.
Well, and I think that's
like we chitty chat, you know, and it's what you do. It's like bar talk, right?
I think that's kind of the point of this show, though, right? Like, we're here to tell you about things that are in the news, but we're also here to tell you our opinions of those things in the news from the point of view of two archaeologists.
Yeah.
Right. Now, and we're generalist archaeologists because we're from the cultural resource management area, and we're not like,
we're not specialized in any of these.
We didn't go to school to specialize in one thing.
No.
Right. So people that write in, they're like, hey, I specialize in this one thing, and here's what you got right and what you got wrong. And I'm like, I really appreciate that.
Yeah.
But that being said, we expect we're probably going to get some stuff wrong. But our job, as far as I'm concerned, is to make you, the audience, think.
Yeah. And go look these articles up and do your research and learn all about it yourself. And then you can write in and tell us how wrong we are. That's fine.
And those of you writing in that are experts, if you want your own show on the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Well, if you want to start by just like getting interviewed, we're always open for that, too. Send us a note. We've got lots of shows and lots of people who like to do interviews. So
better yet, send that note to producer at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Yeah. And our lovely producer, Ash, will guide you to the right show.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right. Yeah. With that, we will see you next week.
Bye.
I'm going to the sauna. Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at arcpodnet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day.
Hey.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.